John Gardner is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Gardner to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for half the executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Huhan Snyder. The Execution Watch for John Gardner begins.
Good evening, and welcome to the Wednesday, January 15th, 2020 edition of Execution Watch. Whether you are listening live or on KPFT, on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM Houston, 89.7 Huntsville, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue. If you are tuning in for Air Voices with your host, Saeed, heard here every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m., please check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled slot. We do welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, you can join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. You can also join our mailing list for all of the latest updates. Tonight, we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Mississippi native John Gardner for the 2005 murder of his estranged wife, Tammy Gardner. Joining us in the studio to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas and Mike Gillespie. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Well, of course, you know, this is the this program is the first and only live electronic vigil where we provide first-hand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally and on the World Wide Web, and we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and in front of the death house in Huntsville. Our reporter, Linda Snyder, joins us now live by phone from outside the death house in Huntsville, Texas. Linda, how are you this evening? We're waiting to get her on the phone. Forgive me of that. So let's go to our panel here in the studio. Tell John Gardner's story.
Well, before even getting into the story, Marlo, I guess a couple of things need to be noted. This is the first execution in Texas.
And in the United States, yes.
In 2020. So we started the year off with an execution. It's January 15th now, and we're doing execution. And this execution is actually one that was tried under the law that allowed for the imposition of life without parole. So a person can be given life without parole even during Gardner's a trial. It could have been life without parole. So just a few changes. We were hoping that when we got the life without parole statute that perhaps the numbers of executions might have been lessened, but it seems that on this one the prosecutors went out of their way to secure the death of John Gardner. This could have easily been just a straight murder case, and even at a capital, it could have easily been a life without parole case. There was nothing particularly dangerous about Mr. Gardner, at least at his age at the time. That would require the death penalty to be done. But this was, again, we discussed this is in Collins County, McKinney, Texas. And we're talking about going back to 2005. The case against John Gardner, Michael, if you want to jump in any time, it's okay with me. The case against John Gardner was based, he was declared to be death eligible for two alternative theories. One, they were claiming that the killing occurred in the course of either an attempted burglary or a retaliation. But the facts of the case is John Gardner was tried and found guilty of killing his wife Tammy Gardner. She was killed by one gunshot that penetrated her skull and went out the window. They never found the gun. The facts of the matter were that John Gardner, their relationship was a tumultuous one. John had been pretty reportedly abusive to Tammy, and she filed for divorce. And she told lots of people that she'd never live to get, she wasn't going to get out of that marriage alive. So she filed for divorce, and against John, she was looking forward to her day of the prove-up. In February, the prove-up date was going to be where it was a waiver divorce, I think it was, Michael.
Yes, it was a waiver divorce, one in which he didn't even have to appear. There was no property, there was no children, it was a routine matter. That's why the whole theory of retaliation does not make sense to me.
Well, the only reason for the retaliation is because the prove-up had to be done.
The prove-up had to be done.
So in order to prove-up, they had to at least go to court, and she had to prove up the divorce. And so she would have had to go as a witness.
Well, the way the courts are these days, they don't even make you go to court to prove up divorces. You submit an affidavit and you get divorced. The whole concept of retaliation normally is in criminal cases. It's a stretch to me to make it in a civil case. The concept of retaliation is to stop a person from testifying in trial. A case like a divorce case, it doesn't need any testimony. The fact you filed the divorce and asked for a divorce, all you need to do is verify it and the divorce is granted. This is a case in which they wanted to kill him. This is a murder. He murdered his ex-wife. He claims he murdered his ex-wife for a good reason, that he felt abandoned, he felt alone, he felt bad that she left him. A lot of men feel like that. That's why he murdered her. Why it's a capital murder case, why he's being executed for it, not just getting life in prison, is because it's the second time he did it. This is the second wife he killed. That's why this is a capital case. And I think they stretched it by calling it retaliation on a witness, number one, and number two, burglary. The concept of a felony committed during a burglary is somebody breaks in your house and kills you while he's burglarizing your house becomes a capital murder. And the reason that's a capital murder is the law presumes that anybody dangerous enough to break into your house was dangerous enough to commit murder. So they consider an intentional situation. But in this case, he went there to kill her. He went there for that purpose. He did not go there to commit a burglary. This is just a murder case. Just like his first case. His first case is remarkably the same. But in his first case, he killed his pregnant wife. He got 8 years. 8 years. Now, because he did it again, he got the death penalty. Honestly, anything different than the facts. The difference is it was the second time.
And I agree to you to some extent. Now we do differ on the retaliation. I think retaliation was a stretch. But retaliation can be not just for a witness in criminal case, but a witness in any kind of forum. But getting back to the facts of this case, John Gardner and Tammy were going through a divorce, and the record reflects, and you brought up abandonment, a rage, which wasn't brought up in the court. But in this case, John and when Tammy filed for divorce, John told her he was moving back to Mississippi to live with his parents. So he moves back to Mississippi to live with his parents, and Tammy is counting down to the day of her prove-up, the day that her divorce is going to be final. One evening, John goes, it is reported that John borrowed the truck of his brother-in-law and told his brother-in-law he was going to be in and around Mississippi, and the evidence seemed to reflect that he actually went to McKinney, Texas, and killed Tammy. He denied ever having left the state of Mississippi, but there were receipts where he bought things in along the route. So they sort of have him in Texas. But he goes, once the killing is done, he's contacted back in Mississippi, and he the word gets out that something happened to Tammy.
I also think that Tammy saw the truck and copied down the license plate numbers when she called the police, and so they know whose truck it was, and they knew that he was driving it because they found his fingerprints inside of it, and they also found some elements of a robe inside the truck. So they have many, they had a lot of evidence that he's the one that did it.
That is. Tammy did call 911, and she said that my husband did this to me. Now, the fibers that were in the truck were not identified as fibers coming from Tammy, but fibers that were consistent with the fibers
on her robe
that were on Tammy's robe. But as we discussed, I mean, so Tammy was shot. Tammy calls 911. Takes dispatch a while to get. There was some discrepancy on the address. Took them over 25 minutes to get there. And when they got there, Tammy was still alive. There was a clean wound right through the brain. She apparently didn't think she was as bad off as she was, and she ended up dying 2 days later when she was taken off life support. They contact John in Mississippi. He denies ever having been to Texas. There was evidence to the contrary that he was, and that he was driving his brother-in-law's truck. And his sister-in-law tells him, John, you need to call the authorities over there. You need to turn yourself in. There was no case file, so there was nothing for John to turn himself in. And he says, well, and when they talked to her, finally we talked to the authorities in Collins County, he was asked about, you know, what happened to Tammy, and he says, you guys can ask Tammy yourself. Didn't say I didn't do anything, mm-hmm. but just said you can ask Tammy yourself.
So his first call to authorities was when he was back in Mississippi? Is that what you're saying? And then contacted the authorities in McKinney later?
The sister-in-law noticed something was wrong, had already received a phone call that something happened to Tammy, and once he acknowledged he knew about it, she put two and two together. She also found her husband's gun with one shot fired, so she knew that he did it. Mm. At that time, she confronted him, and basically then he called the police. The interesting thing is he did the same thing with his first wife. He called the police that time, too, to tell them what happened.
All right, let's put a pin in that right now and go to our reporter outside of the death house, Linda Snyder, joining us live by phone from outside the death house in Huntsville. Linda, thank you for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. I'm here. I'm not happy about it, but I'm here.
Right, of course. Well, describe the scene to us, please.
Well, it's very solemn because tonight, while they were playing the music, you know, the church music that they start at 6 o'clock, mm-hmm. the witnesses already crossed the line. So that meant it's going to happen.
Do we know who the witnesses are by any chance?
His minister was one that I recognized, and that's Brother Wayne. Mm-hmm. And then one friend, I believe, from McKinney was in the list. And then the two chaplains from TDCJ, that's all that went in.
Okay. You know a little bit about him, and we've been told that John was in poor health the last couple of years. Can you attest to that?
Yes, he was in poor health, and he only has one leg. He has health issues, but diabetes was, I think, his main health issue. And he had visitors the first and second day, which is Monday and Tuesday. He had his minister in the afternoon and his two friends from McKinney in the morning. Today he did not come out. He told his minister that he needed to pray up, make sure where he was going. He wants to make sure the gates are open in heaven and that's where he wants to be. So he stayed in his cell, and he's in the hospital there. He's never been, a lot of the guys don't even know who he is because he's been in the hospital for so long at the unit.
There's a certain kind of isolation when you're in a hospital unit in prison. Is that right?
I think so. None of us have ever seen it, so we don't know. But because they do bring him out, like, in a wheelchair when he comes out to visit.
Mm-hmm. What is the atmosphere like there tonight? I've talked to a couple of different activists, and this is one of those that people are shaking their head at. What is it like out there for those of you who are standing.
Well, we're very sad because, you know, we don't feel like this guy is a threat to society at all now. I mean, there is no reason to kill him. Mm-hmm. It's just wrong. Killing is wrong anyway, and I just think that we shouldn't do that to him.
Linda, we heard that he specifically said he wanted to stop the appeals. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, he did. He told everyone. He told his minister, because his minister talked to me for a long time today, and he said he didn't. He wanted to go. He was tired of living the way he was living, and that he knew the attorneys had filed one appeal, which is the Supreme Court for a stay, but he told him don't file anything else.
And I know that things have changed a lot on death row, but can you also speak to the fact that there is no longer any final words, no longer a final meal or any other kind of...
I think they still have a final meal, but they don't really... They can write their words out, but I don't think they really say them in the chamber anymore. It's just it's written on a piece of paper and it's given to, you know, I think the chaplains or something like that, and then they report it to us.
And about having a spiritual advisor in the room with them?
There's no spiritual advisor in the actual room. They're just on the outside, like where all the witnesses stand.
Just behind the glass.
Behind glass, yes.
Can the prisoners see the witnesses?
Yes, the guy being executed, he can see the witnesses, yes. He can see the witnesses that are there for the execution, and if he turns to his left, he can see the ones that are there wanting his execution.
Well, Linda, as always, it's a very sad day, and we appreciate your being our eyes and ears there in Huntsville. Could you please call us when the witnesses cross?
I sure will. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking with Linda Snyder. She is outside of the death house in Huntsville, Texas. All right, let's go back to our discussion here in the studio at 419 Lovett Boulevard. The time is, of course, 6:17. We are waiting now to hear if the execution has been finalized of John Gardner. Let's get back to our panel with Larry and Mike. So it was interesting for me to talk with Linda and find out that this man was in poor health. This man has been in prison now for 13 years or more on death row. But you were talking about abusiveness is one of the reasons why they had filed appeals, or is abandonment? I'm not sure I'm familiar with that as an appeal.
Well, that issue was not even raised in the trial at all.
Mm-hmm.
The what's it called, Michael? Abandonment, rage.
Yeah. The question is that really a legal issue? Okay. It is considered to be a mitigating circumstance of why somebody would do something of rage. It is something that juries can hear to mitigate punishment. But whether or not it's a regular form of science that can go to court and use it as a defense, we don't think so. But the other part of it is by going to court and even raising the issue, you make yourself look dangerous. You make yourself look like somebody that can't control himself. And it's a two-edged sword. On one hand, you want to use it as mercy, but the other hand, you're telling the world that you've got emotional issues and you can't control yourself. Which gets to the other issue in this case. Was this man mentally sane? Was he mentally competent to be executed? You know, one of the things we do know is that when you're not mentally competent, they put you in the mental institution until you're mentally competent, and then they execute you once you're mentally competent. Is he mentally competent? Why would you kill two different people and then call the police afterwards? Why would you do that?
Well,
why would you, Larry?
I don't know, because that's not my line of work, and it's not the line of work of the lawyers. But the lawyers in this case hired experts to advise them. They hired an investigator to investigate the matter, hired two mental health experts, one as a consulting mental health expert, and the second as a testifying mental health expert. Never testified. Hired a mitigation expert, and also hired a risk assessment expert. And so none of these raise the issue of what's the man's mental health state. for them to raise that question. So they were depending on the experts that they hired to advise them on what and formulating the defense. Now, John had no history of any kind of mental health treatment. Not to say that he didn't have any mental health problems, but again, there were two mental health experts on the legal defense team.
Do we know of any evaluation that he ever had prior to these events?
There was no mention of it.
None whatsoever.
And there's no mention of a psych examination by the court, and that's what I question. There's one thing to have mental health experts testify at the trial, mm-hmm. but the question becomes, was he competent to go to trial? I question whether or not he actually, and I would make the argument that he did not consider what he did to be a crime. The argument would be made is that the abandonment issue would be that he felt abandoned by his wife, and that if he's not going to have her, that he's not going to let her walk away, he's going to take her away. If he's not going to have her, it's going to be by his own hand, not by her hand. It's a way of coping with losing your wife. Now, is that a defense? No, it's not a defense. But it's something to come forth and talk about that he wasn't of his right mind. I'm not sure he thought he did anything wrong. Again, I can't get over the fact that you would do something like this and then go and admit it and call the police and not fight it. Why would you do that unless you didn't think he did anything wrong? Maybe he did not. Maybe he should have been talked to about whether or not he knew right and wrong.
But again, we're not mental health experts, and the defense team, the legal defense team, hired two mental health experts. And if there was a mental health issue, then it would have been left up to the mental health expert to direct him in that direction. And I would assume that mental health it's never been raised, okay, in this case. And in fact, when Tammy felt that her life was in danger, she made several statements that I'll never get out of this alive. Tried to disappear. She borrowed money from her employers to file for divorce. The vice president of her company actually picked her up and was with her the day of the killing, took her home, made sure that she seemed safe at home, and within 4 hours after he left, there was a call made by Tammy to 911 saying, "My husband came over and he shot me. He's driving this kind of truck," and so forth. I can't really hear you because of the ringing in my ears. Actually, she was shot through the head, and a bullet went through her brain and went outside. And she said, "There's blood all over the place," and she was walking back and forth. When EMTs get there, she's trying to get out of bed. They're trying to tell her, you know, sit down. You're hurt really bad. They try to make this a dying declaration. All of the things that she said did come in, not as a dying declaration though, but as an excited utterance. But it did come in. John was charged with capital murder on the theory that making him death eligible said it was either, as Mike mentioned before, an attempted burglary or a retaliation. Now, the defense team, in trying a case, pretty much much evidence is a two-edged sword. On guilt innocence, the defense team put on no evidence. And very little evidence on punishment. It was a two-hour verdict after two-day testimony from the state. 2 days of testimony from the state. Defense put on no testimony. Jury was out for four and a half hours, found him guilty of capital murder. Come back and very little evidence on punishment. The defense strategy was primarily to keep the state from proving beyond a reasonable doubt the allegations against John. And the reason for that, and when you look at this case, the evidence of murder was a fairly strong circumstantial case, but it was circumstantial. And a thought in a defense counsel's mind could be, they might not be able to prove murder, but even if they do, they can't prove capital because the underlying the death eligible characteristics, criteria, just fall away. You know, that there was no proof beyond a reasonable doubt of murder, and proof beyond a reasonable doubt of either retaliation or of burglary. That but might be a safe presumption. Now, in the post conviction efforts by the appellate lawyers, the primary claims that were made were that that John's trial lawyers were ineffective, primarily for their failure to develop and present evidence of what's that rage again, Mike? Abandonment rage. Saying put on evidence of abandonment rage in the guilt innocence phase. I think that if they put that on, my feeling is that would have been ineffective. But even in the punishment, they put on abandonment rage and punishment. As Mike has said on more than one occasion, had it not been for the fact that John's the punishment evidence, the prior bad acts, in the punishment phase, what the state puts on is evidence of future danger, and the defense puts on evidence of mitigation. There was no mitigation evidence put on.
And keep in mind, we have more than just him killing his prior wife. We also have instances of him pulling a gun out and pistol whipping this wife, putting a gun to her head and threatening to kill her on numerous occasions. He's got many histories of spousal abuse. The interesting thing is that when you talk about future dangerousness, he's not a future danger to society. He's only a future danger to his wives.
Well, you know, McKinney's a small place. It's not really that large, not even 200,000 people. Can they effectively actually put on a trial like this?
If it's a two-day trial for a capital murder, McKinney has tried more than one capital murder. Okay, and again, they're close enough to Dallas. They're the same lawyers who go back and forth between Dallas and I'm not sure. I think one of them might have been a Houston lawyer. They've got the same lawyers that drive back and forth from Dallas to McKinney.
And I've actually tried a case in that courthouse. It is Dallas. The people are Dallas. The culture is Dallas. It's the outskirts of Dallas.
So not a farming community.
It's a farming community. But in terms of the attitude and in terms of the professionalism in the courthouse, they're the same people.
Okay, so
as in Dallas.
Right. Sophisticated enough to. All right.
They've got experience in trying capital cases in McKinney, Texas.
Have there been a few convicts who have actually been condemned in McKinney?
I'm not sure how many. I think I read somewhere like as many as 13, but I'm not sure. But it's more than just a few.
I know we've had a few on this program before out of Collins County.
Okay. But, you know, going back to your earlier point, this is the very first execution in 2020 here in Texas. And I know that the next one we have scheduled is going to be February the 6th for Abel Ochaya. Do you think this means that Texas is really ramping up its machine again?
This is a political issue, and it ebbs and flows. And really, I was shocked last year with the numbers that we had scheduled and the lesser amount that were actually carried through, that I was beginning to wonder whether we'd sort of decided to tone down the death house. Now, on this one, where he instructed his lawyers not to take any further action, whether that would have been fruitful or not, I don't know. Marl, I can't read them. I don't know if you can read it at all, Mike, but I can't read it at all, because some of the stays that were granted last year sort of baffled me. I think it's a good thing.
I thought there were some very excellent opinions written about many, many issues that had nothing to do with this case. I didn't follow all those arguments on the jurors, the arguments about jurors that shouldn't have been struck and were struck. there were some very interesting decisions coming out. The courts are more interested in the jurors than it were the facts of this case.
You are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. Thank you for joining us tonight. You are listening to Execution Watch. If you are tuning in to hear Arab Voices with your host, Saeed, heard here every Wednesday from 6 to 7 p.m., please check back next week when it resumes its regularly scheduled slot. We are here in the KPFT Montrose studios discussing the imminent execution of John Gardner. Joining us in the studio, of course, is Larry. Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie. And thank you, gentlemen, for being here. My apologies.
It's not a fair thing to say, but, you know, you look at their relationship. She married a man who she knew had killed his prior wife when she was pregnant. She had his name tattooed on her in the thigh. It was a relationship of nothing but violence at all times.
She had the name of the former wife?
His name tattooed on her inner thigh. That is a sign of a woman who is dominated. When you're dominated by a man like that, you know it's a tough situation to get out of. I question why you would even do a divorce and be available. You can file the divorce and move to any state in America. You can go any place you want to. It's obvious that he was going to kill her. He told everybody he was going to kill her. She told everybody he was going to kill him. He was making phone calls saying he was going to kill her. Why would she not disappear? Why would she not move?
Well, Michael, I'm going to disagree with you just a little bit on this. Okay, one, haven't seen the evidence that she knew that he killed his first wife when she married him. Now, she might have found out before he killed her. But, you know, people get together for all kinds of reasons, and a lot of us are forgiving. So if she found out about it, you know, at some point she might not have known when she first met him. But they were married, and who knows what she knew beforehand. But she knew she was in it. And people get married for all kinds of different reasons, whether it's financial dependency and what have you. And not everybody protects themselves. Not everybody has the same options that we have in terms of moving away. She might not have even known how to. I mean, she'd gone to her boss, borrowed money from them, and said, you know, I think I'll be okay. I'm here. I've got the door locked. You know, I might be safe, but then I can't get away from him because he's going to kill me. She's going back and forth with all these differing emotions, and you know, people just have all kinds of different emotions.
I've seen a situation when there's children involved. When there's children involved, it's very hard to disappear because you have children, they're enrolled in school, can always be tracked down. But again, she's a single woman. She could move any place. She could disappear any place. I question why she didn't do it.
We don't want to get too involved in maybe sounding like we're blaming the victim, though, Michael. That's just not what we want. We don't want to go there.
And, of course, we don't want to blame the victim. But does anyone know specifically if their marriage happened in the state of Texas or in Mississippi?
I don't know that for a fact, but I assume it's a Texas
Me
thing.
Too.
She didn't mm-hmm. really have any dealing in Mississippi. Mississippi is where he was from. Mississippi is where he went back to. She stayed here in Texas, and she felt comfortable with him being in Mississippi and her being in Texas. Even though it's a fairly short drive, as attested by his coming over and apparently committing the murder here. Now, and the way the system works, though, Marlo, is that all this bad stuff, this conviction, the prior bad action, so forth, none of that comes in guilt-innocence. In the guilt-innocence phase, it's just a matter of this case and this case alone. The judge tried a case firmly on those facts. Did John Gardner kill Tammy Gardner? The jury heard just from the testimony from the witnesses offered by the state. Now, some of those witnesses included John Gardner's sister and brother-in-law, you know, who testified that, yeah, John did borrow the brother-in-law's truck. Yeah, the brother-in-law has a gun in the truck, Yeah, there was a spent round from the chamber of the weapon, but the empty round was still the casing. Well, there was evidence. Brother-in-law says, whenever I fire, I clean my gun. So, but if there's and there was only one shot fired. Now the round that was fired that killed Tammy was consistent with a brother-in-law's gun, although the bullet was never found. It was said that it passed through Tammy and went out the window, and never found it. The house was still locked up when first responders get there, and Tammy died a few days later when the family took her off life support, similar to the way that happened when 20 years before he killed his first wife by shooting her three times in an ambush type shooting. He had a violent past, but that violent past did not come up at all during the guilt innocence phase. Now during the punishment phase, everything comes in.
A violent past, meaning that there were reports of him being violent towards other people, or people being violent towards him.
Him being violent towards the women in his life, and
their daughters.
The daughters
and their daughters.
But also violent toward him. Okay, now there was evidence that was admitted at trial where the sister did testify that she and John had a somewhat violent past. Their minister father would administer beatings to him right there at church. When John would act up at church, that would take him out of the over to the fellowship hall where people could hear from inside the church, and he'd beat him. And said we could hear the yells and the screams, everybody, and it was embarrassing for John. Now, the sister did testify to all those things. There wasn't a whole lot more about that, though, and the prosecutor did point out the fact that, you know, John's been, he was raised in a home with a mother and a father, parents still married. And this is the way they choose to discipline their children. And there are some people growing up in Texas, certainly my age, who would not raise an eyebrow about a man disciplining his son by beating him with a belt. Okay, I don't know about you guys, but I got beat with a belt myself growing up. Belt switches and what have you. That kind of evidence did come in during the guilt innocence phase. But again, the defense put on no witnesses in the guilt innocence phase. The prosecutor put on 2 days of witness testimony. The defense did cross-examine the witnesses, so they put on, you know, some time of redirect. But then the jury comes back in 4.5 hours and found him guilty of capital murder.
Larry, you agree that even though there was all circumstantial evidence, it was enough circumstantial evidence to make a finding of guilt.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. 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 Now I think critical was the call, the 911 call from Tammy.
From her.
I think that was really critical, and the defense did try to keep it out by claiming, because the state was claiming that it was they had two alternative theories as to why it comes in terms of this is Tammy's testimony, which violates both the hearsay rule and the rule against for confrontation of witnesses, since Tammy's not there. So they were saying it's a dying declaration. But as it turns out, under the law, it was not a dying declaration. And the court went through with meticulous details, being lawyerly focused, mm-hmm. on it does not meet the elements of a dying declaration. It is an excited. Dying declaration, it comes in, even though it's hearsay, because courts have established that it is credible testimony. Because when a person is dying, and they know they are dying, and they make statements describing the circumstances under which they are meeting their maker, particularly if they identify the person who they say killed them, then that is believed to be credible and comes in without, because you can't cross-examine that testimony. But it comes in, but the state says Tammy didn't even know she was dying. She thought she had a headache. And when the emergency technicians come in, they've got to sit her down. And she didn't die right away. Death has to be imminent, okay? And for those reasons, courts allow dying declarations to come in. This was not the court determined. This was not a dying declaration, but it was an excited utterance on to the 911 operator saying, "These are the circumstances that I need to have somebody come out."
So, assuming there was enough circumstantial evidence to find him guilty, the truth of the matter is the lawyer has nothing to put on. There's no eyewitnesses. There's no witnesses to anything. There's nothing he can put on except listen to the state talk about circumstantial evidence. Is this a case where you really might want to put your client on the witness stand to at least personalize him before the jury? Who's going to bring up the hurt and the abandonment he feels except for him? Is this the only time the defendant really has a right to talk to the jury? And he might not admit he did it, but he could talk about blanking out. He could admit about being there, not knowing what happened. But how are you supposed to express your defense, not to get off the case in terms of not guilty, but to make it from not capital to a life in prison case? Don't you need the man to testify about why he did it, why he was hurt, why he felt bad about it?
Okay, now I don't think that the choice is either have John Gardner testify, I have no testimony at all. I mean, they had experts.
But
okay?
Not him.
Well, I'm not sure that he needed to testify.
But who's supposed to, how is a jury supposed to be sympathetic for a man who did it for the second time without hearing from him? And if the defense is abandonment, they want to hear from him and his words how he felt.
We're talking guilt innocence, though.
We're talking guilt or innocence.
If we're talking guilt or innocence, then doing it for the second time doesn't come in because there's no first time. But yeah, but
when he takes the stand, it can come in.
Oh, it can come in then.
Impeach him.
But we have.
Abandonment never came into the actual issue.
Abandonment
of the trial,
rage was never brought up. Never brought
but
up.
But it should have been brought up. The reason to make it not capital.
Okay, abandonment rage was not brought up. This was one of the primary points that was brought up by the appellate lawyers, saying that abandonment rage should have been brought up during the guilt innocence phase. It should have been researched and presented. It was never researched, never presented. And also for the in the punishment phase. The trial lawyers decided, made the decision, we're not going to bring that up.
The time is now 6:43. You are listening to KPFT Execution Watch, and on the phone we now have our reporter outside of the death house, Linda Snyder. Linda.
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you.
The witnesses have crossed back over, so the execution is finished.
Thank you. I know that this is a very solemn time, a very sad time, and we thank you for your expertise and witness.
Thank you very much.
Any
I'm sad
words?
To be here, but yeah. You know, it's got. I don't know. The Texas is just killing machine. That's all I can say this year.
Well, Linda, this is your opportunity to especially address our listeners, you know, behind the walls and internationally. Can you give them any hope about execution
well,
in Texas?
It seems like that it's, you know, like the people are turning against executions more, but the state's not. So I don't know what we have to do to get the governor to understand, you know, he's a Catholic, he should be not doing this.
Right. Thank you, Linda. We will unfortunately talk to you again on February the 6th.
Yes, thank you very much. Bye-bye.
That was Linda Snyder standing outside the walls in Huntsville, where we call the death house. Let's get back to our panel discussion. This is kind of a crusher. This was a crusher. There's so much sadness about so little hope. Let's talk a little bit about the appeals process. I guess we've talked enough about the trial itself and how there were certain elements not brought in that they brought into the appeals process, specifically this abandonment rage.
Well, the courts will give the trial lawyers, as they did in this case, an opportunity to explain their theories as to why they did certain things and didn't do other things. And the whole issue of abandonment rage that the appellate lawyers have raised, the trial lawyer said, you know, that's a two-edged sword.
Yeah.
If we bring that up, because abandonment rage sounds a whole lot like, if I can't have her, if she's going to leave me, I'm going to kill her. And once you bring that up, it's definitely a two-edged sword. It might help you, but it can certainly hurt you. And if the trial lawyers felt, you know, that was their theory, and they will be reviewed on the ineffective assistance of counsel standard, and that is, was your performance substantially subpar performance, and did that performance cause harm to your client? And when the appeals court looked at that and say, no, we don't see ineffective. We don't see ineffective.
I think the abandonment issue might work on the first murder. It doesn't work on the second murder.
But as a theory in itself, I mean, is this something we're going to hear more and more of?
They're real issues. More and more in a society where we have a society where people are impersonal, personal relationships become very, very vital. People need personal relationships. And one of the trouble with men is men do not easily make personal relationships. Men have a code that they stand by, that they keep everything to themselves. In many cases, the only person a man really talks to is his wife. The only really person he reaches out to and shows the soft side is to his wife. And when she leaves him or she turns on him, it is much more serious to him than anybody else, because that's the only place that he vents. That's the only person he can let out his real feelings. And it becomes a real issue. I see it a lot in divorce practices. We live in a world now where more and more men are opening up to their male friends and talking more, and this is not an issue. But we're talking about a different world now. We're talking about a world in which a man is important, his woman is important to him, that relationship is important to him. It's the only one he has. And to lose it can be very, very, very important to him.
On this case, well, just a couple of things, Michael. That abandonment rage scares me as a defense. I mean, it might be appropriate in some cases, but it scares me on a general basis.
How so?
It still sounds too much like, and I can see it coming back to haunt you, from the prosecutor saying, this guy's saying, if I can't have her, I'm going to kill her. Okay, and that... that other side of the edge of that sword frightens me. Now, I'm not opposed to putting a client on the witness stand. I'm not one of those lawyers that client never takes a stand, but I can't see John Gardner taking the stand with all the stuff he's got in his background. And the as lawyers, we still have to depend on the experts, and they hired all these experts to assist them. But we have one mental expert who not only not necessarily turned on, but her response after interviewing him is that I can't be of any use to testify for this guy. I'm not even going to let you have my notes, because I don't want them to get into your hands, because if they get into your hands, they're going to get into the prosecutor's hands, perhaps. If they get into the prosecutor's hands, it's going to hurt him. I think the guy's psychotic. Okay, now, that was what that expert purportedly said. Now, and that became one of the appellate issues, saying that the trial lawyers should have taken more strenuous actions to get those notes from the expert that they had hired. I can tell you that there are certain things that, as a lawyer, you might not necessarily want to know about your client. Okay, especially if it can possibly be used against your client. We don't have a Hippocratic oath, but you don't want to do harm to your client. And so the lawyers, but the appellate lawyer's job is to look to grade the papers and see that the trial lawyers do their job. And if there's anything that's conceivably wrong, we want to bring it up.
So how do you defend this guy if you don't want to let him take the witness stand because he can be impeached? You have no witnesses. You have nothing. You just sit there and listen to the state go on and on about what a dangerous man he is, and we just sit there? There's nothing we do besides let them take pot shots at him?
Opening statements, cross-examination, and closing arguments. Those are our tools. Okay, those are the primary tools that a defense lawyer has to convince the jury what that they can't make the case, and then cross-examine their witnesses, and then final argument saying they did not prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt.
On guilt and innocence, you're correct, but on the difference between life in prison and the death penalty, you have to humanize the man. And the only way I think to humanize him is by putting him in a situation where he's talking to the jurors. It might not help him in guilt or innocence, but it didn't help him by saying nothing. But it can humanize him, make them feel that he's not a recurring danger to anybody except his wives. What else do you have besides him? And isn't he your best witness?
And it's theory of the case. That might be the proper theory. Okay, in this case, perhaps, but you only get to try it one time. This was their way of trying their case.
But they didn't do anything. They just listened to all the allegations. They didn't put anything on.
They didn't put any witnesses on during the guilt-innocence phase, but they, I'm sure, vigorously cross-examined the state's witnesses. Because we always say we don't have anything to prove. You know, Voight and I always say, you know, I can go over here and take a nap right now if I want to, and not do anything, not cross-examine a single witness. And if they haven't proven their case beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must. The oath says you must find him not guilty. So they depend on that. And that was what they depended on in this case.
You know, I can sit in court and I can talk in detail about how a dog threatened me and how a dog met menacing faces at me and how a dog intimidated me, but not unless that jury sees the actual dog and talk to that dog, are they going to understand that this is just a chow, is not a Doberman. I think that sometimes what defense has to be is look at the person who's making the threat. This is not a violent person. This is a sad person with a complex in terms of relationships that he can't stand to lose.
Perhaps, gentlemen, but to me it sounds like a case of ownership.
I'm not sure I understand what the ownership of...
Ownership of his woman.
Huh? Correct.
Oh, yeah.
Of course it is.
The issue of him being controlling and possessive was repeatedly used throughout this. Yes. Yes, he wanted to be in control.
And that is the real issue over here. We have a world in which that is not a proper way to be, and that's not the way the world lives anymore. But he comes from a culture that was the way you were raised. That man is in control. Now, that doesn't justify what he did, but part of these things need to be explained. My God, maybe he comes from a background, the fact that your wife left you is an embarrassment, that it's such a humiliation that you can't stand it, that you have to have your wife with you even if she hates you just because you can't let the society know that she abandoned you. There are men like that.
And that's why the whole issue of abandonment rage scares me as a defense. It just does.
But maybe it can. We're not talking about defense on guilt or innocence. We're talking about a reason not to have him executed. I think it's a reason to show he should not be executed.
I understand. I just disagree. And we're close to being into the end, aren't we?
We are very close, but not quite there. If you are listening to KPFT right now, you are hearing Execution Watch right here on 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in the wonderful world of Huntsville. Thank you for joining us today. I'd like to remind everyone that if you are interested in some of the things that are going on with the death penalty here in the state of Texas, well, of course, we always ask you to check in with us. This is the only live electronic vigil that was started, of course, by our producer, Elizabeth Stein, and Ray Hill, the first host, many years ago at this point in time. I think, Larry, you've always been on the panel. Mike, you're sort of the new guy with only 5 years or so.
I haven't always been here. I got called in by Jim after they'd been doing the show for a while before Jim talked to me. Jim called me in to do the billboard and then ended up calling to getting me to stay.
Yeah, And so you've had a lot of these announcements and pronouncements regarding, as we just did, that the death of John Gardner has now happened. They have taken his body out of the chamber. They have removed it to the chapel where whatever his remains, whatever will happen to his remains, if they will be claimed or put into a prison burial, whatever happens at that point. But if you are interested specifically in some of the things that happen with the state of execution and the death penalty in Texas, there are a lot of different places that you can actually check in and learn more besides here at Execution Watch. And, of course, our website and Facebook page, you can always join us there. We're very happy to see you at executionwatch.org, where we have a mailing list for the latest updates as well. We will be doing some live recorded interviews coming up in the next couple of months with some of our inmates who are on death row. So please join us again for that. We appreciate it if you would come back for that. And it's always interesting to listen to what you have to say, Larry, Mike, and to feel what's going on. I really appreciate your wisdom as it is. It is time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us again on February the 6th, 2020 at 6 p.m. when the state of Texas plans to execute Abel Ochoa. We invite you to visit us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Join our mailing list for all the latest updates. And please stop by kpft.org to show your support for this program and others, and make your secure contribution to this station. Thanks again to our panel, Larry B. Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Death House reporter Linda Snyder, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, and our engineer Rick Campbell for their assistance on today's program. Up next, People of Earth. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.